CEO versus Maribel Bautista Sabio. Mr. Williams and Ms. Calloway. Morning, Council. Mr. Williams.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Anthony Williams, on behalf of Appellant Anthony Robert Sabio.
Would you like to reserve any of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. With the Court's permission, reserve 3 minutes.
That'll be granted. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. This appeal is here for this Court through an appeal to several orders from the trial court, that being the circuit court.
Let me interrupt you and see if we can kind of synthesize this. There's 10 assignments of error, but would it be fair to say it boils down to two major issues, one being simply the attorney's fees issue, the other the interpretation of the language of the PSA and its addendum?
That is a very fair summary, Your Honor, and I appreciate that. And I will take them in reverse order. The interpretation of the APSA language by the court was...
Well, simply and let me see if I can cut even further to the chase, which is simply, what does the term marital share mean when used in the PSA?
Yes, Your Honor, and it is plain from the language in the APSA that the parties intended to divide the FERS account by way of the marital share. And because there is no there's no need for a definition of what the marital share is, just like in the McGinnis case, which is actually an equitable distribution case where the court referred to the mandatory nature of 20-107.3's language when it defines the marital share. Because there is no specific definition within the APSA, the court should apply the statutory definition of marital share because there is no ambiguity in that. It clearly says marital share.
Let me interrupt you, counsel, and just ask this. I guess maybe it's a hypothetical, but it seems to me we've got one of two options here. Either... since the parties didn't separately define the term, either they intended the statutory definition or they intended the ordinary meaning of the phrase marital share. Would that be a fair assessment?
Well, no, Your Honor. We don't need to get to their intent. We're applying the plain wording that's in the...
Well, here the court took parole evidence on what the term was intended to mean, and I gather part of your assignments of error is that was error for the court to do that.
Because
it was unnecessary.
Yes, Your Honor. And even when the court takes parole evidence, they can only take parole evidence on those specific terms that are ambiguous, not the contract as a whole, not to rewrite the contract, not to determine what the parties could have meant by what was set forth in the words in the contract, but what are the plain words meaning of the contract. And applying that analysis, there's several things that are plain by reading the contract that there was and this again was drafted by the appellee and rules of construction of contracts. The drafter should be, it should be construed against the drafter. First, it states that the husband has a TSP account, and then it subdivides it. There's two subcategories of that, and it states that the FERS account, the wife will get one half the balance of these two accounts on the date the husband officially retires. And that, taken at face value, means that because the FERS account is a defined benefit plan with no balance on the date of retirement, that she gets nothing. However, that clause is then modified by the following clause, which states that the wife will get 50% of the marital share by way of a quadrant. And the court, I think, would be fair to apply the 50% of the marital share to the FERS because it does modify the FERS statement, which again, kind of cuts her off with a zero balance as the date of retirement. There is no division of the TSP account in here. There's a division of the two subcategories. There's also the plain language, which is not open to interpretation, that the husband will draft the quadros after 30 days after his official retirement from the CIA. He's not retired. He won't be retired for many, many months or years. And what the court did was essentially, because while this might not be what the wife wanted it to say, even though she drafted it, the court essentially rewrote it to state what some of the things that she said during the trial. And even at trial, she testified, her testimony, she didn't know what she was writing. She had no idea of what marital share was. She had no idea what these accounts were. She thought it was all part of one, that's clear in the testimony. The only party that mentioned something that is very close to the statutory definition is Mr. Sabio, where he said that it was his intent that she would get one half the marital share, and he defined it as the date of marriage to the end of the separation date, or words to that effect, which is a very close analogy for a layman as far as what it means. But again, I don't think the court needs to get to what these parties intended. On the one hand, we have her with no idea what she intended.
Well, maybe I was inarticulate, but it seems to me we have to construe the or decide what that phrase means, as the trial court did, and the trial court erred in taking parole evidence and doing what it did to ascertain the intent of the parties, or it didn't. So either, and certainly it's a phrase used in the code, but it seems to me with any language in any contract of any sort, when you're construing it, you look at the words and you either use the plain meaning, which is the ordinarily understood meaning, which you usually can find in a dictionary, or you use a different meaning that's determined, either predetermined by the parties or by reference to the law or something of that nature. That's simply what I was getting at there.
Yes, Your Honor. And the problem with trying to determine what the parties meant or could have meant is that both parties are testifying with hindsight as far as what they wanted it to mean as the date of the hearing. That being said, the wife was unable to really establish what she meant when she drafted this document.
But if it is ambiguous and confusing, the court can consider parallel evidence, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
On page 75 of the appendix, it looks to me like at the bottom of that page, you took the position that the amendment to the property settlement agreement was inconsistent and confusing.
Which doesn't necessarily mean, Your Honor, ambiguous. Inconsistent because you have a TSP account, which the parties know there's money in there. It's a defined contribution plan, but it's not reflected on the face of the contract. And then there's two subcategories of that. And the first paragraph, or the first sentence dealing with first, states that she gets half the balance. And then the second one, which is actually modifying it, says she gets 50% of the marital share.
Well, I was a little confused by that point because you seem to be taking the position that the phrase marital share in the contract means one thing, but marital share in the addendum means something else when there's no clear indication of that. So it seems to me that the proper approach, whichever way you go, is to interpret the phrase consistently, whether you use the statutory meaning of the term or the ordinarily understood meaning of the term.
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying that the term marital share is either inconsistent or ambiguous. You have two sentences that address the FERS account. One says 50% of the balance as of the date of separation, which again means she gets nothing because there is no balance on a defined benefit plan. And then the second clause, which modifies that first clause by saying she gets 50% of the marital share, which is a fair and equitable interpretation of the contract, the plain face meaning of the contract. Just as anyone who buys a house doesn't read 100 pages worth of definitions of what is meant, do they know what the terms meant in that contract, the courts know and apply that term on a regular basis as far as marital share goes. It is between, it's a, the fracture, coverture fracture, beginning with the date of marriage that overlaps the service up to and including the date of separation. And it, again, it's not subject to interpretation. And so while there are terms that are inconsistent, arguably,
But you said not just very consistent and basically nonsensical. I think you also said they were very confusing. So
right, when juxtaposed against the previous PSA and what I knew the party's intent was, half the marital share, because it's confusing because it doesn't say, well, confusing, again, juxtaposed against what the real intent was. But again, we don't have to go to parole evidence and determine the real intent. It's on its face, it's not confusing and inconsistent. It just when, you know, knowing what the parties wanted to, what my client thought was he was signing, it is different. And because it does not, the words of the document do not effectively reach the intent that I believe the wife.
But you didn't argue below that as I think Judge McCullough alluded to, you didn't raise below the or take the position that the that provision you just referred to was unambiguous, as you're taking now on appeal for the first time.
Actually, let's see. I did argue, and
you argue below, and I'm looking at Joint Appendix 75 to 77, that the amendment was factually inaccurate as to what the retirement accounts were subparts of others, and then on appeal you take the position that those provisions are unambiguous, which seems to be inconsistent.
Well, they're inaccurate as far as, because it says the TSP account is comprised of a FERS account and a Ready Reserve account. I know that to be factually inaccurate, but that's not what the contract says. And the party should be held to the terms of the contract. I'd like to move on to the attorney fee issue.
Well, just to let you know, you're now starting into your rebuttal time if you want. You can use it if you want, but I just want to let you know you're using up your rebuttal time.
I will reserve that time. Good morning, Your
Honor. Right, Ms. Calloway.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Ann Calloway. I represent Mary Bell Savio. Of course, it's our position that Judge Whitlock did not commit any error in, first, her decision to take parole evidence on what the parties intended by the use of the phrase marital share in the amended property settlement agreement, and really in the first one too, since the phrase was included in both. And second, that Judge Whitlock didn't err by her evidentiary rulings after hearing the parole evidence, that neither party relied on the statutory definition.
Well, let me interrupt you, Ms. Calloway. It's a general rule of contract construction that we don't construe the language to be meaningless,
right,
if we can avoid that. And so it seems to me, looking at if we were to construe the agreement to mean that the parties intended that the wife receive 50% of the husband's total benefits upon retirement, wouldn't the term marital share be rendered meaningless? In the phrase 50% of the marital share of the FERS and Ready Reserve account, wouldn't that be just a totally meaningless phrase at that point?
Well, if we just took the contract without considering the party's testimony at the hearing, it would be puzzling, which is what triggered the concern about the ambiguity in the first place. Because when the time came to draft the quadros, you're looking at it thinking, well, what does this mean? So, and you know, obviously the resulting hearing didn't happen in a vacuum. There was obviously disagreement over how the quadro should be worded, which led to the hearing. But my position is and has been that to these parties, based on their testimony, the term marital share to them meant the amount of money that they were dividing, that was being split. And what I specifically...
But I mean, that's certainly a possible construction of the language that you've just articulated, but that's not the only possible construction.
No, and
when courts are expected to construe these things, if one construction renders a phrase meaningless and another construction, you can harmonize them, we go with the one that harmonizes them, don't we?
Absolutely, okay. And that's what I was trying to do, and that was what my argument was, is how do we harmonize this? And it's harmonized by the fact that the parties didn't know what the statutory definition was, and they believed...
Well, that's what they testified to with the parole evidence, but setting that aside for the moment, just looking at the plain language, it seems to me you can harmonize them also without reference to any outside evidence by, and tell me where this is wrong or a flawed analysis. If you view the agreement and the amendment as a whole and conclude that the parties intended the statutory definition of the term marital share, then you can easily harmonize the language, can't you?
Well, that would render the first part meaningless, the part that says that his accounts would be divided as of the date of retirement. It would render that part meaningless.
And didn't the, I don't have it in front of me, but didn't the agreement say the amendment completely superseded? So then that language becomes ineffectual, because if you're going to start construing them together, you can't do that when it says the other one is wiped, the previous one is wiped out. It's a mess.
I think so. I think that the only way that the first agreement helps, if that's the right verb, is to try to tease out what the parties intended. By comparing that paragraph, I think it was paragraph 27, I can't remember off the top of my head for sure, but that's why in my brief I compared line by line to try to tease out what they were really trying to do. And I think that obviously they agreed that the paragraph 27 in the first one was null and void. Okay, that's fair enough. I got that. But then if we start comparing sentence by sentence, I think it helps clarify what they were trying to accomplish. I think it's important to keep in mind that, as Mr. Williams said, Mrs. Savio drafted the amendment to the PSA.
Well, paragraph 28 of the amendment,
maybe it's 28.
Doesn't that language mirror the statutory definition and also the case law? It's the paragraph, in pertinent part it says, the marital share of the husband's military retirement shall be determined by dividing the number of months of creditable military service by husband during the marriage and prior to the date of final separation of the parties by the total number of months of creditable service earned by husband upon the date of his retirement. Notwithstanding the same, it shall be agreed, wife shall be entitled to one half of the husband's net monthly income, net monthly payments from this account. That's on page 13 of the JA. Doesn't that mirror the statutory language?
It sounds close. I mean, without both of them side by side, it does sound. I mean, the fraction part is the way we typically create the marital share of a pension, of a defined benefit plan, when you can't quantify that before.
Well,
if that's
the definition in an amendment which supersedes any conflicting provisions of the prior agreement, isn't that the definition parties intended to use? I mean, how do we get around that?
Well, again, I think that's the problem. I think that's the exact problem that led to...
Well, I mean, is the answer to my question yes or no?
I don't think that's the answer, because I think the rest of the language about the retirement accounts in the amendment create the ambiguity that resulted in the hearing.
But if the amendment has language that says whatever's in here supersedes whatever else is out there previously, and this expresses fairly clearly the party's intent as to what the construction of the term marital share ought to be, I mean, I guess my first question is, why would anybody need parole evidence if that's the state of affairs?
Well, I think that the need for parole evidence was created by the phrase that the accounts would be divided as the date of his retirement. I think that obviously conflicts with statutory definition of marital share. That created the ambiguity. That led to the parole evidence and the reason.
Your client drafted the amendment.
She did.
Right? So if there's this contradiction or confusion about it, shouldn't it be interpreted against the person who drafted it?
That's a standard rule of construction, that it's construed against the drafter. Yes, yes, absolutely. So yes, I agree. That does apply in the drafting of contracts, unless there's language. Sometimes they say, you know, it's not construed against either, but I don't think that was in this one. I think that if I still have time left, I just want to refer to the Craig versus Craig case that was decided February 7th, 2012 by this court. And it's at 59 Virginia App 527. And in that case, the parties got into a conflict over drafting a quadro. And actually, the conflict didn't arise until after OPM implemented it and deducted the survivor benefit premium twice from the wife's share, because OPM had a different definition of gross annuity than what everybody else, how everyone else defined it. And this court decided, so the issue was whether the trial court could modify the quadro to fix the problem so that the wife wasn't paying for the survivor benefit premium twice. And so they came back to revise the quadro, and that the court fixed it. And then the husband appealed and said that the court didn't have the authority to modify the quadro, et cetera, et cetera. And what this court says, it said, thus, the husband concludes the reference to the CSRS, the Civil Service Retirement System, in the instant case expressed the party's intent to incorporate all the regulations and definition of the CSRS. We find this argument unavailing. The mention of CSRS refers only to the source of the annuity payments. There's no evidence that either party was aware of the CSRS rules, regulations, or definitions, nor intended to incorporate them by reference. I think that's the exact issue we have here. In the absence of any proof that either of the parties were aware of the statutory definition, then they couldn't have intended it to apply. Therefore,
even though you have that definition of it in the earlier agreement that Judge Humphreys referred to,
they didn't refer to the statute, but it referred to the fraction. That part was referred to. I mean, neither Mr. Williams nor I were the lawyers involved in version one, so we can't give any opinions about what all that meant. But you know, that's a typical way to calculate a marital share of a defined benefit plan, but there was no reference to the statute. I mean, frequently parties will come up with their own method of dividing things, not only retirement benefits. One of the ones that's, you know, a really common area of dispute is the cohabitation terminating alimony paragraph, and parties will write their own version of what's in the statute. And it's my belief, based on, you know, cases I've dealt with and my reading of the law, is that unless they really reference the statute, they can agree to anything they want. And that just by putting in some wording that's similar to the statute doesn't necessarily invoke all the statutory requirements. And of course, just to be on the safe side, anybody that's, you know, paying attention would specifically say, and 20-109, I think it is, does not apply. But I think that's the same thing in this case. Unless you specifically reference the statutory definition in a situation like this, then we're stuck with the party's language that they came up with. And that's what needs to be enforced. Thank you.
Going from 76 to 77 on the top, that's where I say we don't need to go there. It's referring to parole evidence. That is my preservation of that issue. moving on, there's no discussion on the record that April 1st would be used to draft any of the orders or to enter any of the orders. That's completely random. It's clear that the orders were not to be prepared until after retirement. The prejudice is if the court decides that the TSP wasn't divided, obviously, well, then she may have spent it and my client will not get it back. My client's not able to take loans against his TSP or use it in any statement of assets. It opens up the possibility for double dipping. She received one half of the TSP as of April 1st, and then pursuant to the APSA, now she can go back when he does retire and say, I want 50% again, and then we'll litigate it and probably, assumedly, arrive at the correct result.
Can I ask you on the attorney's fees? Because you were getting ready to earlier talk about the attorney fees.
Yes, Your Honor.
Let me ask the question.
At that March 25th, 2014 hearing, where in the record were attorney's fees actually requested? Can you?
Yes, Your Honor. They were requested in writing in my motion, and then the act of handing up my affidavit for attorney's fees is in essence a request for attorney's fees. Because they were asked for in the motion, where they're litigating the motion, and I handed up my affidavit of attorney's fees.
And the March 25th order had them in there, but they were scratched out, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then, but both counsel signed the order without?
Well, yes, Your Honor, and there's some factual discrepancy, disagreement between counsel as far as what happened thereafter. It was March 25th, snowing heavily in Culpeper. Everybody was in a hurry to get out of there. The court did not handle the order itself, but counsel for both sides and appellant, we went into a room outside of the chamber. Well, the court directed to bring the order to her lower chambers, which is on the second floor. The courtroom's on the third floor. We go out there. Ms. Calloway scratched through some wording. I read it. My client read it, initialed it, and then gave it back to her. And I went out to get my calendar so that we could check to make sure that the April 1st hearing was okay on my calendar, because I wasn't allowed to bring my cell phone. I handed back the order to her. She then went down to the second floor. I don't know. I do not remember. My client does. Well, we remember that the language for attorney's fees was not scratched through. And I did not see the order. The judge didn't sign it until the 26th. We argued on the 25th. She signed it on the 26th. And it wasn't until you read the transcript of the next hearing on April 1st when I asked the judge for a ruling that Ms. Galloway said that was scratched through, and the judge says it wasn't reserved, and it wasn't ruled on. It wasn't reserved. I forget her exact words. And there was no actual.
Well, let me just non-confused. I'll just maybe you could help me out here. We've got this order with the language scratched through, and I just heard you say, maybe you misspoke. I don't know that. No ruling was actually ever obtained on that point?
Correct, Your Honor.
Well, if no ruling was ever obtained, how do we have jurisdiction to consider it on appeal?
Actually, on the second transcript, the judge said that the issue wasn't reserved, and so I'm denying the request for attorney's fees. She did deny.
Oh, so there was a ruling?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, all right.
Kind of disjointed ruling. Because I did not even see that order until after the April 1st hearing, and that's why, if you look at the transcript, it's kind of caught on the.
Is there any subsequent order entered that actually reflects that?
No, Your Honor.
I was afraid of that. Okay. I think your time is up, so.
Yes, sir.
We'll come down to Greek Council and take up the Wara Wara Corporation.